Anybody got a blank seat next to them? Please pull in close so we can have the blank seats by the aisle so people can find a seat when they come in late. Okay, so we have Twitter card responses from last time. And we'll be doing this on a regular basis. Excellent Twitter card responses last time. And if you recall, the Twitter card question was, okay, we talked about architectural values. You don't solve indeterminate design problems without having some kind of external force that comes to the problem. In good design, that is often the values of the designer brought to that problem. And so I was asking you about architectural values you might have, even at this kind of early stage of the class. So here are some of the responses. Someone says, my main architectural value is that the best architect another one, my chief value is simplicity. We complicate our own lives and accumulate a lot of clutter. When we live simply, we get a very clear idea of what it is we need and what we actually desire. Architecture can help us do this. Someone else says, my values in architecture are to bring people closer to nature, for buildings to make people see the beauty that's in our world. The building should coexist with the planet, not just stand on top of it. Somebody else says, I think architecture should be a direct reflection of who its inhabitants are, an intimate consideration of their psychological state and their personal values. Someone else says, as an architectural value, or an architectural value I have is longevity. Coming from a Mexican background, my family always took pride in the making of houses and how stable and long-lasting they were. And then this one's kind of an alternate point of view. Someone says, one architectural value I uphold is how adaptable a building can be. In our age when advancements are unpredictable and crucial, a building should be able to change, to improve. Someone else says, architecture should be about pushing the limits of the materials, whether traditional or modern. Buildings should appear technologically impossible and inspire wonder. Someone else says, an architectural value I have is one of historical significance. A building that holds stories and memories, evokes emotion. This is a key trait of human experience. Finally, someone says, spaces and buildings are meant to promote community and togetherness. So those are pretty wide range of values. For some people, it's all about nature. For some people, it's all about the personal characteristics of the inhabitants. For some people, it's about longevity. For some people, it's about change. And this is the way the world should be. We make a better, richer architectural environment if, in fact, we have many values imbued in that environment. And I think in a diverse world, it would be absurd to think that all buildings would be built to the same values, because we are different in our values. So today, we're starting the beginning of kind of one-third of the course that is going to be on issues of form. And in your course outline, you could see we had these few introductory lectures. And now we're going to have a whole series of lectures on form. And then we'll have a whole series of lectures on physical considerations. And then we'll have a whole series of lectures on human factors. And then we'll have a few wrap-up lectures at the end. Now this form, physical considerations, human factors, that division comes from a kind of adaptation of the work of a Roman architect back in the time of Christ, a guy named Vitruvius. And Vitruvius wrote the first treatise that we know of on architecture. It's generally called 10 Books by Vitruvius. And we have that intact, and it's really a wonderful series of kind of books is a little bit glorified. It's more like 10 articles that Vitruvius wrote on architecture. And in that, he outlined what he thought were the three primary concerns in architecture. If you're going to make good architecture, you have to be concerned with these three things. And those were firmness, commodity, and delight. These are often referred to as the Vitruvian triad. Nobody can study architecture with any seriousness without understanding the Vitruvian triad, which is firmness, commodity, and delight. Now, in many ways, I think nothing has changed in that regard since Vitruvius's time. These still are three primary things we worry about in architecture. But I would say in the 2,000 years since then, we have changed our demands on architecture. And although those general categories work perfectly from my point of view, the words specifically maybe aren't the best. So we're modifying those words. So when Vitruvius talks about firmness, what he meant was, does the building stand up? Is it stable? And certainly we worry about, does a building stand up today? But I would say we're now worried about all kinds of other physical considerations, like, does it stand up? Now we not only want it to stand up, we want it to keep us warm in the cold weather and cool in the hot weather. We want it to work with the topography and the geography of the area so that it doesn't create flooding problems and other deleterious ecological factors. There's all kinds of physical considerations that we expect buildings to deal with. So instead of the word firmness, we're going to use the term physical considerations. But it's still that kind of category of issues. Vitruvius was also concerned with commodity, and I actually quite like the word commodity. It talks about accommodation. Do the buildings respond, accommodate functions, you know, life of people in the building? And that's certainly what Vitruvius was referring to. But we're going to stretch that a little more too, because these days I think we're not just interested in accommodation, but we're maybe interested in provocation. Do buildings stimulate us? Do they get our attention and make us think something we wouldn't have thought otherwise? We're interested in the psychology of buildings, the sociology that buildings represent. Maybe a little broader than just that word commodity implies. So instead of using the word commodity, we're going to talk about human factors. And we'll have a series of lectures on human factors. And then Vitruvius used the word delight. And I love the word delight. That's great. Buildings should delight us. But again, sometimes we have other expectations of buildings. Should they just delight us? Maybe sometimes they should provoke us. They should shock us. They should, you know, anger us even. Is it possible sometimes, like we'll look at a building that's a Holocaust museum, and it's meant to talk about this horrible event. Should that delight us? Is delight the right word? Probably not. But there is something in the visual character and the emotional reaction to that building that is important. But maybe delight's not the right word. So we're going to talk about all kinds of issues of form. That is, how is the visual character of a building, how does that affect us? Our emotions, our feelings, how does that impact us? So instead of firmness, commodity, and delight, we're going to be talking about physical considerations, human factors, and form. And today we start the first of four or five lectures on form. And you know, we're not going to be able to cover all the ground by any means on form, but this is meant to give you a sense of how architecture can be this visual thing that affects us in our senses. So this is very much the world your book is talking about in experiencing architecture. It's issues of beauty, issues of aesthetics. And Rasmussen talks about a whole lot of the things we're going to be talking about today in class and in the next few lectures. So that book is very tied to issues of form. Things like he has chapters on texture, or chapters on color, chapters on light. These are things, they're issues of form, the aesthetic or the visual experience of architecture. So at the beginning here, I want us to talk about why the hell are we worried about beauty? Why are we worried about aesthetics? Why are we worried about the visual character of anything, not just architecture? And I would say one kind of overriding thing that most of us use beauty for is it's a status symbol. It's an expression of prestige. I have a beautiful car. Damn, I'm cool. I've got a beautiful car. I've got beautiful clothes. It makes me feel good. I've got beautiful clothes. This is a beautiful diamond ring, and it cost a freaking fortune, and it shows I'm powerful in a certain way. Beauty is a huge currency that we use to show prestige or status or power. And I don't want to diminish that, and I don't want to deny that, but I want us to go a little deeper than that, a little deeper than just, yes, that's beautiful, how cool you are because you've got a beautiful boyfriend, or how cool you are because you've got a beautiful house, or whatever. But is there something beyond cool or beyond status? And I want us to investigate that by going back to this medieval philosopher who was also a churchman, a guy named Abbot Suger, S-U-G-E-R. And this guy, Abbot Suger, was asking the same questions. What is the role of beauty in culture? And why would we be interested in beauty? And there are two quotations from him that I just love. One of them is, man reaches the contemplation of the divine only through the senses. Man reaches the contemplation of the divine only through the senses. So the way we get to know God, and this guy is a churchman, he wants to get to know God. The only way we can get to know God is through our sensory experience of the world. And that is significantly our visual experience. So Abbot Suger's notion is that when you see the beauty of the sunrise, or you see the beauty of the sunset, that's one way you can get some glimmer of how amazing God is. Now, this is profound. Is it through our senses and through our experience of the visual world that we somehow understand the divine? We understand something bigger than us. And for Abbot Suger, that was a role of beauty. When you saw something beautiful, it transcended everyday life, and it gave you a sense of what God was. So the other quotation is, let me get that quotation exactly right. Hold on a second. So Suger said, the dull mind rises to truth through that which is material. The dull mind rises to truth through that which is material. Okay, what he's saying here is that we actually understand some facts, some truths by our experience of the material world. So for example, let's say you see a spider's web and you're attracted to it because it's beautiful. Maybe there's dew on that spider's web, and it's delicate, and it's sparkling, and it's beautiful. And then it provokes your curiosity. What? How did that get made? How is it so strong? That it is our experience of the material world that makes us curious and makes us want to know more and provokes us to get truth. That would be true in many examples. A flower is the kind of sexual organ of a plant. And seeing that beautiful thing then begins to provoke, what are those pistils about? What's the stamen about? What's the role of the petal? And it provokes a curiosity that then it makes us inquire or makes us seek truth. So Abbot Suger is saying beauty is not just there for, yeah, that's cool, but beauty is there because it connects us to truth and to the contemplation of the divine. It makes us want to know more, and it makes us understand something bigger than ourselves. Now, he was a medieval philosopher, and you may agree with him, you may not agree with him, but in medieval times, they were very concerned with beauty, and they spent an enormous amount of cultural capital to make beautiful things. One of the beautiful things they made were Gothic cathedrals. And now people travel from all over the world to go to France and see these amazing Gothic cathedrals. And they go there because there's something profoundly beautiful in those cathedrals. And they've lasted for hundreds of years. And people find them still quite meaningful. And there is something, I gotta say, when I go into one of those Gothic cathedrals, and I see that amazing light coming through those stained glass windows, yeah, I get a sense of the contemplation of the divine. All these years later, but they invested so much in that era in making this beautiful thing that would seek truth and seek the contemplation of the divine. Sometimes I wonder in our own culture, do we understand the profoundness of this, how important this is? Those artifacts have lasted, have transcended time so beautifully. Isn't this something that is profoundly there in the human experience? And should we be incredibly invested in making beautiful things to enrich our lives? So there is a medieval verse, same period, that espouses the same philosophy that I have, when I was your age, I first encountered this verse, and it has been very meaningful to me for all my life. So don't write this down, just listen to the verse. It goes like this. If of thy mortal goods thou art bereft, and of thy store two loaves are left, sell one, and with the dole buy hyacinths to feed thy soul. If of thy mortal goods thou art bereft, and of thy store two loaves are left, sell one, and with the dole buy hyacinths to feed thy soul. Now, that's a philosophy that says beauty is as important as physical sustenance for our bodies. Beauty is as important as bread. Beauty is as important as anything we do in our life to sustain us physically, because it feeds our soul. So now that begins to make this whole issue of beauty a little more important than just prestige or power. That's pretty important, just the prestige or power thing. But wow, if it really is about seeking truth, about the contemplation of the divine, about feeding the soul, now that's another level of importance. So there maybe is an argument in the 21st century that says, oh, well, but beauty is such a slippery thing. You can't, I mean, beautiful to one person is not beautiful to another person. This is not something we can quantify. We're all about data. We're all about quantification. If you can't measure it, it's not real. Have you heard that? Bullshit. Well, but, you know, okay, we want to be able to scientifically analyze and make a conclusion. Is it beautiful or is it not beautiful? And you can argue with that position or not, but I would actually say, yes, in a certain way, we can talk about things that are beautiful, and they're maybe even dependably and quantifiably beautiful. So if you just think of all of our senses, if you think of the sense of smell, okay, for pretty much 99% of the people in this room, if I let them smell bread baking, they would say, that smells good. That's a beautiful smell. if I let them smell cow manure, they would probably almost universally say, yuck, that's disgusting. So there are something in our senses, just by the physiognomy of our bodies, that makes some things a beautiful smell and some things not a beautiful smell. The same thing would go for our sense of hearing. If I played Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, most people in here, whether you like classical music or not, they would say, that's beautiful. That's a beautiful piece of music. If I played 3 minutes of jackhammering, most people would want to run out of the room. It's horrible. That sounds terrible. That is not beautiful. That's ugly. So there is something in the sense of hearing that is universal to all of us. Even the sense of touch. Pretty much anyone, if you touch mink, oh man, it just feels so incredibly beautiful and soft and luxurious. It's wonderful, the touch of mink. Whereas if I ask you to put your hand in a vat of gutted animal entrails, ooh, slimy, disgusting, not beautiful. So there is something in our senses that makes some things beautiful and some things not beautiful. And we can understand that. So in terms of our visual senses, let's think about that a little bit. Is there something innate in our DNA that makes some things beautiful and some things not beautiful? Or is it an acquired thing? Is it something that's cultural, that we learn to find some things beautiful and some things not beautiful? So there was a very interesting study that was done here at UT, probably 15 years ago, that looked at the beauty of the human body, both male and female human bodies. And they were looking across all times, is there something in the proportion of the human body that is universally found to be beautiful? I mean, you can look at like Roman statuary, like the Venus de Milo, and the girl's a little chunky by our measure, but she was considered beautiful. That was beautiful body at the time. You know, a runway model now, chicks are kind of skinny, you know, but they're considered very beautiful. But is there something that transcends that? That would be true of women in Roman times and women in the 21st century that we could find universally beautiful. And in fact, these people, you know, measured that and looked, and over time it is true. There is something that's kind of universal. So almost always the ratio of the waist to the hips is 0.7 to 1. So Venus de Milo is a little chunky, but she's 0.7 to 1. And the runway model's a little skinny, but she's 0.7 to 1. And they found that for the male human body, that ratio is 0.9 to 1. And you can, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger, built up like this, 0.9 to 1. Or it's, you know, swimmer dude that's got a swimmer body, kind of thin and elegant, 0.9 to 1. So there are some things we can understand as universally beautiful in the human body. Now, you know, I think actually yes to both of those. Yes, it's innate. Yes, it's learned. But I'm not so concerned about that as us finding a way to discuss what is beautiful and what is not beautiful in architecture and to understand that there are going to be some variations of that. But there probably are some terms or some qualities that we can find are more or less universal. The other thing that I think is interesting for us to figure out in this discussion of beauty is to just think of how much it is imbued in our culture. I mean, we're obsessed with some beautiful people like Angelina Jolie. So do you think Angelina Jolie is on the tube and on the magazine cover and everywhere in the world because she's a great intellect? I don't think so. It's because she is badass beautiful. That woman, oh, holy shit, that woman is beautiful, right? Okay, so we can agree on that. But it's not just that. I mean, we're obsessed with that kind of beauty, but also if you think of something like sports, Often in sports, what we love about sports is beauty. So, you know, that diver. Diving is a very aesthetic sport. It's about, you know, complete control of your body to enter the water as elegantly as a fish does. You know, it's that beauty, gracefulness. That's what we admire. In ice skating, in slalom skiing, even a skateboarder, you know, those moves and the quickness and the dynamism, and it's beautiful. We often say, oh my God, what a beautiful pass that was. It's beautiful. So these are things that are in our world everywhere. And we need to understand in architecture what makes something beautiful. And I'm going to suggest that there are 12 elements of form, 12 issues or ideas of form that contribute to making any building beautiful. And most of the session today is about exploring those 12 elements of form. So you need to get these definitely down in your notes. The first of these is balance. Balance. Second is proportion. Proportion. The third is symmetry. Symmetry. The fourth is light. Light. The fifth is space. Space. The sixth is shape. Shape. The seventh is line. Line. The eighth is color. Color. The ninth is material. Material. The tenth is scale. Scale. The 11th is rhythm. Everybody spells this wrong. R-H-Y-T-H-M. Rhythm. And the 12th is texture. Texture. Now, I'm going to be making the argument that anything we want to analyze in terms of its beauty, we can understand it better if we filter it through these 12 elements of form. And I'm going to be asking you, I will guarantee one of your first test questions is going to be asking you to look at a building and use this means of analysis and tell me about its beauty, but analyze its beauty in terms of these 12 elements of form. Now, it also happens, I think, that people are sometimes more inclined to one element of form than another. I know for myself, I'm a real rhythm guy. Oh my God, I mean, it's a huge aesthetic preference of mine. At my home, I have all of these serial things. I have 12 pictures of dance halls in Central Texas that set a kind of rhythm in my entry hall. I have 30 pipes from pipe organs that set a kind of rhythm in my upstairs bedroom hall. I have 9 leg splints designed by a very famous 20th century designer on the wall above my sofa. The rhythms, the repetition, this is a source of great beauty to me. For other people, perhaps rhythm isn't so important, and color is what they respond to. Or for someone else, it's texture that they respond to. And your Twitter card question today is, I want to know for you, which of these 12 elements of form most resonates with you? Don't write it now. Listen to what we talk about. Maybe we'll get a little stronger idea of what some of these things mean. And then think about, what is it in aesthetic preferences of any sort? When I choose a new car, is it a shape I'm interested in? Is it the color I'm interested in? Is it that smooth texture I'm interested in? What is it that really appeals to me in my choice of a car? What are aesthetic preferences that are personal to you? So for most of the lecture today, we're going to be exploring what do these mean as regards architecture. But We're going to begin by saying, okay, let's just think about these 12 elements of form, but think about them in two dimensions in terms of, let's say, paintings. So these are two very, very famous, very expensive pieces of art. They were both done in the early 19th century. On the left is a painting by Jean-Auguste Ingres, a French painter. On the right is a painting by John Constable, a British painter. One is a landscape painting, one is a human figure. But I'm going to say that we can analyze both, or pretty much any painting, according to these elements of form, and understand why we might find it beautiful. So the painting on the right is in the Art Institute of Chicago. It's about this big, and it's just stunningly beautiful. And I'm sorry to say that a slide of it does not do it justice, because it's got tremendous detail in the painting. But let's talk about a few of those elements of form. So this is a painting with a nice sense of balance. You can see there's a tower over here from the little village, and that's kind of balanced by the figure and the trees on the other side. So there's something on this side of the painting that's important, and something on this side of the painting that's important, and a sense of balance there. It's a very interesting painting in terms of color. It's got these harmonious colors, blues and greens primarily. Deep greens, little bits of yellow green, deep blues in the sky and in the clouds. But this wonderful palette of blues and greens. And you know, if you threw in a, I don't know, purple, oh, wow, it'd be jarring and awful. No, the harmonious beauty comes from a very careful balance of color. Another important quality here is light. You get obviously the light from the sky and shining on the clouds, but also picking up the end of the little building over here, picking up the white of her dress over there. If you could see more detail in this, there's a little woodland path that goes down through the woods here. There's dappled light on it. There are many different beautiful light qualities in the painting. Another element of form that's strong here is texture. The texture of the clouds. You can almost touch them. The texture of the trees. Actually, the texture of the paint. He's using paint to depict texture in nature, but it's texture of paint and nature that is beautiful in this painting. So we could go through other elements of form, but that gives you an idea of what we're talking about. So the painting on the left, although a very, very different painting, also has those same four elements of form. So there's a very strong sense of balance here. There's the drape on one side that's balancing the posture of her body on the other side. If that drape weren't there, whoa, that painting would be unbalanced. It would not be as beautiful. It wouldn't feel as stable and comfortable. So it's got balance. Also, the color in this painting, very carefully selected, beautifully harmonious color. Now the sort of blues and greens, they're there, but now there's this sort of golden ochre, and it's there in the bedclothes, and it's there in the peacock feathers, and it's there in her scarf here, little bits of ochre in there, little bits of ochre in the print on the drape there. Beautiful, harmonious colors. Incredible sense of light. Ooh, the light on her skin, and the contrast of her skin kind of glowing against that black background. The light catching the folds in the satin drape here. The light is very, very beautiful. Makes you almost able to touch this painting. And that's how the voluptuous quality of her body is really depicted by the light. It's also a wonderful painting in terms of texture. The texture of her skin, the texture of the silky drape, the texture of the peacock feathers. Wonderful here. And then there are other qualities. There are interesting shapes here. The shape of her breast, the shape of her butt, the shape of her heel, the shape of her eyes. These rounded, soft shapes. The shapes are beautiful in the painting. Line is very strong here. That curvilinear line of her hair and the line of her arm as it moves down there, the line of her leg, these sensuous, voluptuous, flowing lines in the painting are a source of beauty. So by using these elements of form, we can begin to understand what it is that's making that painting beautiful. And we can do the same thing in architecture. So we're going to look at, I think, 6 buildings today. And for each of them, I'm first going to talk about why did they want to have beauty? Why do we want beauty in architecture? What was the provocation for it? And in each of these cases, it's a very powerful lust for beauty. And then we're going to talk about then how did they achieve that? What elements of form contribute to the beauty of that building? So the first of the buildings is one of those Gothic cathedrals, Chartres Cathedral. Many people think of it as maybe the most beautiful Gothic cathedral. It's a fairly early Gothic cathedral. And people make a pilgrimage from all over the world. It's freaking nowhere. I mean, Chartres is a tiny little town, 30 or 40 miles, I guess, southwest of Paris. And it's hard to get to, but still, you go there any time of the day, any time of the year, and there are going to be tourists from all over the world coming to see Chartres Cathedral. Why are they coming to see Chartres Cathedral? Why? Because it's freaking beautiful. And when you're in there, you're like awestruck. It's beautiful. So it's people seeking beauty. Now, the reason for the creation of Chartres Cathedral is there was a very wealthy see who lived in Chartres, and he was very close to the royal house of France. And he had acquired, at great expense, the tunic of the Virgin Mary that she was supposed to have worn at the Annunciation. So when the angel came to Mary to tell her, you're going to have the Christ child, this is the dress she was wearing at the time. Now, was it really? Of course not. But they were very big into relics in medieval times, and this guy had been convinced, I have the tunic that Mary wore at the Annunciation. He brings it back to Chartres, and he says, we're going to build a beautiful place to house this beautiful relic of the Virgin Mary. And the provocation, the reason why we need to make a beautiful thing, is for our religion. The beauty supported the importance and the reverence of religion, and especially the reverence for the Virgin Mary. So how could we not make the most beautiful thing we could possibly make if we want to revere and commemorate the Virgin Mary? So the town gets behind this. The whole region gets behind this. The King of France gets behind this. And they want to make this beautiful place to commemorate the Virgin Mary and to house this relic from her life. And you can see, I mean, it's a little one-horse town. There's not much town there at all. And out of nowhere comes this massive, amazing cathedral. So there you see it in its context. Unfortunately, much of the town has been destroyed by bombing in the World Wars. But when they bombed, they did not hit the cathedral intentionally. You know, when Hitler occupied Paris, he did not bomb Paris because he couldn't stand to destroy the beauty of Paris. So even in war, when people do horrible things, there was a respect for this beauty. But you can see, always, the cathedral loomed above this tiny little village. Okay, let's talk about some elements of form. This is a building with very interesting balance. It is not symmetrical. It is vaguely symmetrical, but you can see this tower is totally different than that tower. And there's a certain moment at which your eye maybe wants to say, whoa, fix it. Make those the same. I want symmetry. But it doesn't have symmetry. Instead, it has this much more complex thing of balance. And what happened was, at the beginning, this is, as I said, an early Gothic cathedral. So when they started building it, they were still using the Romanesque style, which was a heavier, more solid kind of architectural style. And they built that tower. And then some years later, very quickly, the Gothic style was catching on. And it was much lighter and thinner and more delicate. And so they built the second one. They didn't want to go back and build it in this old, out-of-date style. They wanted to, you know, we're making progress. So they did it as a Gothic tower, but they made it taller but lighter to balance with one that was shorter but heavier. And there is a wonderful balance between the two towers, and in some ways, maybe more beautiful in a complex way than if it were perfectly symmetrical. So balance is a virtue here. Another very strong characteristic here is texture. Every single surface of this thing has rich texture. Sometimes it's sculpted texture, sometimes it's just the texture of the stone. Sometimes when you look at the whole building, there's just a texture all over it, a very tactile, very delicate texture to the building. And that's everywhere. It also is a building with very, very strong rhythm. And here we see the rhythm of the flying buttresses as they troop along here, sort of bam, 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 rhythm. Bang, 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 rhythm. Why is rhythm important to us? You know, rhythm is intrinsic to us as human beings. Your heart beats with a rhythm. Bam, 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 bam. So something inside you is like something in this building. And there's a connection in the rhythm of our body and the rhythm of the building. Sex is rhythm. Whatever. But you know, it's rhythm. That's something that's just built into us. These beautiful things that are rhythmic. And this building has very strong, very beautiful rhythm. All the way through it, inside out, everywhere, rhythm. Another amazing thing about the building is scale. Okay, you drive up to the whole city and it's like, whoa, that is one big-ass building. The scale is impressive, monumental, phenomenal. Part of what makes it beautiful is its scale. And then as you drill down, look at the front facade here, these three portals, the kind of front door of the building. And that scale is tremendous. That is a huge, huge door. That's the size of people, and they really enter this tiny little thing. But the door there is a scale of God. This is God's house. It's not going to have a tiny little door like that. It's going to have a big, big door. This is for God. The scale is impressive, and it's part of what makes it beautiful. And then it scales down to our scale as human beings. It is God's scale, and it's our scale. It's got a real range of scale in it, and you can see that on the inside. The monumental scale of this arch, then broken into a smaller scale for those arches, and then up here in the gallery where people can walk, a much more human scale of those arches through there. Another tremendous quality here is light, light and dark. At moments, it's mysterious and almost spooky in this cathedral. And then in other moments, it's just flooded with light and bright and beautiful. And those contrasts of light and dark are a real source of beauty. And then a final element of form here is color. The stained glass, it's the original stained glass in the building. They, in medieval times, knew how to color glass, and then that ability was lost. And for many years, we could not make stained glass as beautiful as this. It still is just some of the most beautiful, rich color of the light coming through the glass, and the color really, really amazingly beautiful. We can understand why Chartres Cathedral is beautiful. It has a very sophisticated dealing with some of these elements of form. Okay, fast forward almost 500 years. But now we're still in the same general vicinity. This is a palace, late Renaissance Baroque palace. It's called Vaux-le-Vicomte. And there's a very interesting reason why someone wanted to make something beautiful here. The guy who built it was named Nicolas Fouquet, F-O-U-Q-U-E-T, Fouquet. And Fouquet was the minister of finance to Louis XIV, who was king at the time. But Louis XIV got to be king when he was really young. And so he had to have a regent, and he had to have all these advisors that were really running the kingdom, because he was like 6 years old or something when he became king. So these guys were running the show, and they were accustomed to making all the decisions. And Nicolas Fouquet was a genius at finance, and he made very good decisions for France, and he was keeping the monarchy flush with capital. He was also a real lover of the arts, and he considered himself quite a connoisseur of art and architecture. And he wanted to build a palace for himself that would be the most beautiful palace anybody had ever seen. And so he searches all over and tries to find the most talented young talent that would help him do this. And he gets a young architect named Louis Laveau and a young landscape architect named André Le Nôtre and a young interior designer named Charles Le Brun. And he put the three of them together and he said, I want you to make the most beautiful palace that's ever been made anywhere. And he was minister of finance, he had a little cash around, so money was no object here. And so he built the thing in a relatively short period of time. And in 1661, he had a big party to celebrate the opening of his new house. And he invited all of the important people in Paris. This one's about maybe 20 miles to the southeast of Paris in the Fontainebleau Forest. And he invited all these people out to spend the weekend and to celebrate the opening of his house. And he included the king on his guest list. So everybody came out there and they had fabulous food, and fabulous wine, and they had fireworks, and they celebrated the opening of this badass, beautiful, beautiful house. It was a great party. And then the next morning, Nicolas Fouquet was arrested, and he was put in jail. So at that point, Louis XIV is about, he's like 19 years old, but he's no fool. You have something that beautiful, it's power. When you make something that beautiful and you live in that house, that's power. And wait a second, I do not want my minister of finance having power. I want me to have power. And I'm not a kid anymore, and I'm tired of this, you know, these guys upstaging me. No, I won't let that happen. So he puts Nicolas Fouquet in jail, and this becomes his house. And Louis XIV moves in. And then he takes the same three designers and he says, okay, you're going to do one better than this. I want you three to start all over again and do the most amazing, and now much, much, much more extensive than this one. And that's how he created Versailles, we looked at a few times earlier, where he built the whole town and the whole palace and the whole gardens of Versailles with the same three people. But this is the beginning of making that kind of beauty. And the beauty was there for power. We talked about that earlier. It's a source of prestige and power. And that's what Nicolas Fouquet wanted it for, and that's what Louis XIV wanted it for. Okay, how can we understand in this beautiful palace and gardens, what is it that makes it beautiful? One thing, just sort of above all, is symmetry. This kind of relentless, amazing symmetry of the gardens, of the building in the gardens, of the various rooms. It's just relentlessly symmetrical. And there again, why is symmetry somehow meaningful to us? Because we're symmetrical. You know? It is us. We're symmetrical. And we see a certain beauty in that reflection of something that's intrinsic to us. So there's symmetry everywhere. Another powerful element of form here is shape. That beautiful bulbous shape of that contrasted with the rectilinear shapes or the angular shapes. These collections of shapes are making that beautiful. And in the garden, it's the conical shapes of these plants and the shapes of the hedges put into fleur-de-lis. You know, it's a crazy thing to do to a plant to make it, you know, shaped like that. But no, it's all about shape. It's making nature become this very special shape. Another really important element of form, inside, outside, through the whole thing, is texture. It's the texture of those plants. It's the texture of these rooms. Every surface of the room is articulated to make this rich, rich texture. And this is something that these days we just think that was over the top, and we really don't want to live with that much texture. But at this moment, where you were trying to just show wealth, 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 it was texture was a device for doing that. Another very strong element of form here is color. And in some ways, some of the colors we saw in those paintings, this is really the colors of the odalisque. The blues, the ochres, the little bits of red, always harmonious, beautifully put together color. Another strong element of form here is scale, but in a different way than Chartres Cathedral. So this is actually the boudoir of originally Nicolas Fouquet and then Louis XIV. This is basically the bedroom. Now, if you're a really rich, important person, you have to have a bedroom that has the scale that matches your importance, right? You got to have a big room. You can't, you know, have a closet to sleep in. So this is a big room. It's palatial, this whole big room. But then, seriously, what do I do in the bedroom? I'm like, you know, taking my drawers off and, you know, changing in my bed. Do I really want to do this in a like an auditorium-sized space, a big, big room here? So then there is another scale. There's the scale of the whole room. And then there's the scale, a smaller scale, for just the kind of more intimate, personal part of the bedroom. And then, again, do I really want to sleep in a big space? Maybe I'd like a little more intimacy. So then the canopy bed makes yet another scale inside that. So you have the scale of the room, you have the scale of the intimate space, and then you have the scale of the bed. It's very careful in dealing with scale. It also is a very powerful place in terms of space. These shapy spaces. This is the ballroom where people were meant to dance, and the whole space feels like dancing. It's fluid, it's lively, it's a beautiful space. So, again, with these 12 elements of form, one can analyze, understand, talk about what makes this a beautiful building. A third building. This one is the same time period as Vaux-le-Vicomte, but on the other side of the world. This one's in India. And the provocation for this one is if Chartres was religion and Vaux-le-Vicomte was power, the motivation for this one is grief. It was built by a grieving monarch. So it was built by Shah Jahan. Shah Jahan was the emperor of a huge empire centered in India. His father, Akbar the Great, had put the empire together, but he had been a very successful soldier and had conquered new territories and expanded the empire to the largest empire on the globe at the time. And his cohort in all of this was his favorite wife. He had many wives, but his favorite wife, a woman named Mumtaz Mahal. And Mumtaz Mahal was widely considered to be the most beautiful woman in India. In addition to that, she was his chief military advisor. She went with him on these crusades, and she was brilliant as a military advisor. However, Mumtaz Mahal died at the age of 28 in the birth of her 10th child. A pretty remarkable woman. But Shah Jahan was devastated when Mumtaz Mahal died, and he committed himself to build a tomb for Mumtaz Mahal, and that became the Taj Mahal. And the idea was that he would build it on the Agra River here and eventually there would be a bridge that would go across the river, and there would be a tomb for himself out of black marble on the other side of the river, and their love would forever be commemorated in these two buildings. He spent 22 years building the building. There were 20,000 people who worked for 22 years on this building. 20,000 people. Wow, an enormous mustering of resources. He stopped being this great general that was conquering lands. He just concentrated everything on building the Taj Mahal. He was obsessed with this commemoration to Mumtaz Mahal. And in fact, he neglected everything else in the kingdom so much that his son, Aurangzeb, who was the heir to the throne, was afraid there wasn't going to be anything to inherit when his father finally got through being irresponsible. So he actually deposed his father, took over the kingdom, put Shah Jahan in jail, although the jail was the Agra Fort just down the river, which was a palace. But he incarcerated his father in this palace where he could look and see the Taj Mahal, but he never got to build the rest of his dream there. And he died eventually in the Agra Fort. So the idea here was to assuage his grief by making this beautiful commemoration of this woman he loved dearly, Mumtaz Mahal. So what are the devices by which he did that? Again, very prominently symmetry. Also very much here, proportion. And proportion is sometimes something, there's a whole chapter on proportion in Rasmussen's book that should help you understand proportion well. But here it's a notion of, if you made any of those arches, let's say half as wide as they are, or twice as tall as they are, there just would not be the harmony or the beauty of proportion. If that dome were twice as tall, it would be out of proportion. There is some harmony here in all of the parts working together and making proportion. The symmetry here is not only, you know, as we walk toward the building down the main axis, but it's the entire complex. This is actually what we see there as the main Taj Mahal. On either side symmetrically is a prayer hall and a guest house. This is the gate you go through, so the symmetry is emphasized there. The symmetry is emphasized by this. The whole garden has bilateral symmetry. Again, symmetry is a powerful force here. Another very strong element of form here is shape. The shape of those arches, the shape of the bulbous dome, the shape of these towers, those rounded, solid, massive kinds of shapes, very important. Interestingly enough, I think one of the strong elements of form here is color, although the color is white. But this white marble has the ability to take on other colors. So the slide on the left is one I took early one morning. Went out and the fog was still over the Agra River, and as the sunrise came up, and you know, when you make a slide in a digital, it sometimes doesn't all pull through, but there's just a kind of orange color in the building, very subtle orange color. And then we had made that trip in particular to be there when the moon was full, so that you see it under the full moon and it turns blue under the light of the moon. They're very subtle, very beautiful colors in the white of the Taj Mahal. Another really important thing here is material. The whole freaking thing is made of marble, this relatively precious stone. And then inset into the marble are other semi-precious stones like coral and lapis lazuli. And the marble is carved very beautifully, as marble does well. Originally, there were precious stones, rubies and emeralds, set into the building. Those have mostly disappeared. But the materials were part of what made it incredibly beautiful. They were precious materials. The scale of the building is astounding. Just, you see all those little bitty people there? I mean, you see a picture of this and you don't think about the scale. But when you compare it to the size of the people, it's astounding. I went to see the Taj Mahal when I was in my 20s. And then I went back a few years ago, and I thought, I know this building, I've been here. I went because I'm with my brother on that trip, and he'd never been there, so we go to the Taj Mahal. And I go in there, and I'm like, oh, shit, I was blown away. It's bigger. It's so amazingly huge. And my memory of it just couldn't hold its scale. But it is, it's mammoth. But then when you get close to it, it also has a human scale, the scale of your hand or your limbs, because of the ornamentation and the breaking down of scale in the surface of the building. Also, it's very powerful in terms of light. You go through this dark portal, they get you, your eyes really, really, really dark, and then it opens up in this bright, white, shining light. The light is very strong, and then it's really the light that makes all those curvy shapes so beautiful and voluptuous. Okay. Next building, again, pretty much the same era. This one is called the Temple of Heaven. It's in Beijing. Again, the Asian side of the world. It's a Ming Dynasty building. And the provocation here was affluence. People wanted to be rich. They wanted to have material goods. And they thought that once a year, if the king prayed just right to the gods, that they would have a good harvest and they would be affluent. So they built a temple here just for that prayer from the king to the gods to ask for material wealth, for a good harvest. So the whole complex of buildings, and in particular this one space, is in order to have affluence. Again, these things get, you know, you see them over and over, things like symmetry. The whole thing is very axial, and the symmetry is strong. The scale, again, amazing. It's a huge building. The scale of the space around it is huge. And only the Chinese make these just incredible spaces. The spaces have an extraordinary scale. And this one is like that, too. The shapes are very powerful. These pagoda kinds of shapes of many different sorts. But it's evocative, beautiful shapes. It also is texture. Every surface, again, has these rich, repetitive textures. Underneath here, all those eaves, beautiful texture, all the structural members, tiny little members collectively holding it up. Color, oh my God, these deep red, rich colors in every color, red, blue, yellow, green, incredibly colorful place. And then rhythm. Rhythm at a certain scale of bang, bang, bang of the pagoda. But then also the rhythm of all these tiny little pieces that set up another kind of rhythm entirely. Again, you know, it's a beautiful building because it incorporates these qualities of color and shape and texture and scale and symmetry that are something we can kind of begin to see as universal. I mean, these things you can depend on helping to make a building beautiful. So let's shift gears a little bit and look at, these are our older buildings. Let's look at something in the 20th century. This one is the chapel at Ronchamp, done by Le Corbusier. We'll be looking at a lot of buildings by Le Corbusier this semester. Rasmussen has many examples of buildings by Le Corbusier, certainly one of the most important architects of the 20th century. This is a tiny little chapel that he did in rural France, way on the eastern side of France, almost in Switzerland. And the purpose of this building was spirituality. There had been a miraculous event, presumably, that occurred in this spot. In medieval times, an angel had appeared to a little girl in the village. And so to commemorate that miraculous event, they built a chapel. And then in World War II, that chapel was bombed and destroyed. So they wanted to rebuild it. But now the town wasn't really there anymore. There wasn't a reason to have a church there. But there was this spiritual event that had happened there. And interestingly enough, the Catholic Church hires Le Corbusier, who's a freaking atheist. He's not even a religious man. So this is not really about religion, because there's not going to be any service. There's not going to be any mass that's held here. And it's not really being designed by someone who has strong religious feelings. But they challenge Le Corbusier to just make a spiritual place that gives us, that lets us know as Catholics what role spirituality plays in religion. So that's really what the building is about. It's a building that's very strong in terms of shape. It's almost a piece of sculpture. And sometimes it's angular shapes, and sometimes it's bulbous, curvilinear shapes. As you move around the building, it's a shape shifter. Wow, it's just really different from different angles. But it has these sculptural, amazing, interesting shapes to the building. It's also a very strong building in terms of line. The line as it creeps up like that, or the strong vertical line like that, or the soft line across there. Just as we saw in the Odalisk, those combinations of sinuous lines make something quite beautiful. The texture of the building is very strong. It's made of concrete, and it has this kind of nubby texture all over the surface of it. And then occasionally, that's actually a plaster on the concrete, and occasionally the concrete is left bare, and it has a texture of its own. It's also interesting in terms of color. It's basically white, but then there are these moments of primary colors, red, blue, yellow, green. Sometimes it's in the stained glass, or sometimes it's at a kind of erogenous zone of the building. That's the entry door, and it's rich with color. All of these primary colors. And then there also is color through the stained glass windows. It's a very powerful place in terms of space. Inside, it's a very unusual space with a lower ceiling in the middle, and then it rises up on either side, and then the light creeps in. But that shape of that space is very unusual and very kind of intimate and spiritual. And you can see it in plan, very interesting, different spatial qualities, little alcoves off of the main space. And then very powerful in terms of light, little bits of light coming in. This is one of the relics saved from the bombing. This was a wooden sculpture of the Virgin Mary. She's lit from behind. She seems to glow. So that's given emphasis by the light. And then there's all kinds of light that's brought in high and colored by the blue wall, and it drops down or brought in subtly against the texture of the plaster. Light is very strong in the building. And then another powerful thing is rhythm. But now not the bam, 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 bam rhythm. This is the rhythm of jazz. This is staccato rhythm. This is bing-a-dee, bing, 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 bing. You know, but still rhythm, but rhythm in quite a different way. Okay, final building. This one is a building that pretty much everybody knows. It's the Sydney Opera House. It's on travel posters. It's an emblem of the whole country. Very, very famous 20th century building. What it was meant to express was nationalism. They were going to build an opera house, and they decided we're going to make this an expression of how important we are in Australia. Here we are down in the Southern Hemisphere. Everybody always forgets us. We're going to make an opera house that will be a landmark, will be an emblem of Australia. That's what they set out to do, and they, damn it, they did it. So they had this big worldwide competition. Joern Utsen was selected for it. Very prominent site in the harbor of Sydney, and built this iconic national expression. The building originally was budgeted to be $3 million. This is back in 1956. It ended up costing $100 million. And it took 17 years to build. This is like a Gothic cathedral length of time. I mean, in the 20th century, buildings usually built in a year and a half or 2 years. 17 years to build the building. It was an epic undertaking. But now, of course, it is very successful as an emblem of Australia. You can't get a seat to attend a performance there. It's an iconic building in the entire world. Now, what contributes to its beauty? Certainly balance. This wonderful balance between the sails that are aiming one direction and the sails that are aiming the other direction, and this balance between the two. The texture, it's made of these shimmery, beautiful ceramic tiles, and it sits in the water, and there's a kind of watery, reflective quality of the building that makes it glow, and the texture, smooth texture now, not rough texture, that's very important to it. The shape, these bulbous sail shapes, and everybody's got something it reminds them of. Some people think it looks like turtles humping each other. Some people think it looks like old style nuns' habits. I mean, people have different associations, but it's a very evocative, very powerful shape. It also has an incredible scale. They loom over the city and over the harbor, and it's in this very prominent spot. So the scale, it has to hold the scale of that whole harbor, and it does. And then it also has incredible rhythm. Again, kind of a staccato rhythm, and then in some places a much more regular rhythm. But all the way through the building, from detail to the macro quality of the building, it has a very strong rhythm. Okay, Twitter card question time. Of all these elements of form we've talked about, what is the one that seems to be resonant with you the most, and why do you think that one speaks to you? What is it that speaks to you, and why do you think that's true?